Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We have a lot of content, as I said several days ago. There's a lot of content to get through so that you understand. This is an immersion of the contract and the terms and definitions of the contract. And when I say the contract, I mean the Constitution. So what we're doing is we're actually going through how the Constitution was defined and explained to the states during the ratification process. Why is this important? Because this is how the Constitution is to be interpreted and understood and operated. In other words, it's not how they've chosen to be able to act, operate, and exercise powers. It is by how it was defined. That's why I refer to the Constitution, just like the framers do, as a compact or a contract. That is why this is very important in understanding how it was defined. That way we can actually see what they're supposed to be doing in contrast to what they're actually doing. So we have a lot of content. We've already covered the Massachusetts ratification debates, and right now we're currently going through the Pennsylvania ratification debates. We're almost through those. We should hopefully be through those today. If not, we will be in the next episode of Reclaiming the Republic. We'll wrap them up and start with, I don't know, maybe New York, North Carolina, Virginia. I like saving Virginia for last, and technically I should probably save New York for last, because if I go through the New York ratification debates, there's probably no really good word for it other than they suck. And that's because the mastermind behind the New York, or supposedly the mastermind behind the Federalist positions in the New York ratification debates, was Alexander Hamilton. And Alexander Hamilton, instead of, because he understood, because he was a lawyer, he understood contract law. He understood that he didn't want to overcommit in defining the contract as limited and so forth, because he had designs that actually prove that he wanted to completely disregard how the Constitution was defined. He wanted to use as much of the ambiguity that he could find and exploit so that he could go. And actually, if you think about it, the Anti-Federalist helped him in identifying ways he could exploit it by using their exact same arguments. So the question is, which arguments are valid, the Anti-Federalist or the Federalist? I know, I remember Bob Zadig wrote a book about the Anti-Federalists were right. No, they weren't. They had no base, or I should say, what they stated created no base on the Constitution. All they were doing was they were basically being contrarians. What matters is what was sold in the ratification. So in other words, if I have an argument that is against you accepting this contract, and, you know, Billy Bob over here has the argument in you accepting the contract, and he goes through all of the points. This is why you need to accept this, and it does this, and it'll do this. But I argue, no, it's going to do these things, it's going to do these things and these things. And he goes, no, this is clearly defined to do this and only this, and this is what this means, and this is what this means. And you accept his definitions, then everything I said is erased, because it has no bearing on that ratification. You completely rejected and accepted, this is how we understand the Constitution. We accept these definitions. And so when somebody else comes along and they start obscuring, they actually have to either have base or they don't. And what Hamilton was doing, he had no base. He had nothing within the Constitution or within the definitions and clarifications as he was trying to start using, quote unquote, air quotes here, implied powers, that there's these implied powers in the Constitution. No, there's not. And as a matter of fact, in the ratification base, they said that there were no implied powers. There are only enumerated powers. If it's not enumerated, then it cannot be even exercised. It is not a power. It is a void power. And so this is so important to understand, because once you understand, it becomes like black and white. If it's not in the contract, it's black. If it is in the contract, it's white, or vice versa. You know, because most people, when you write on page or paper, it's with black ink, and white is the base for the contrast, right? And so, well, there's a lot of white space on paper. And in the contract, there is a lot of white. In other words, there's a lot of things that aren't in it. There are only a few things that are in it, if you understand the ink being black and the paper being white. They did not include all the things and everything. And the easiest way that they could have done that was by giving them, as we've read through yesterday, the day before, and so forth, a general constitution that gave them general powers. General powers were the portal for abuses and so forth, and they understood that completely. This was so done. This was done with such brilliance, and the fact that these men were able to harness and understand what they were doing and how they were inspired to do these things, it's just amazing. For 200 years ago, I can't think of another way or a better way of, you know, creating a contract for government. I mean, it's just that simple. But anyway, what I want to do is I just want to remind you that if you cannot listen to the entire broadcast today, you need to use the listen line, which is 605-562-4209. The other listen line is 605-313-0599. Now, I'm not going to get into any news, and we're going to plow through these ratification debates. One of the things this really helps me do is it helps me lay down a foundation where you are hearing it from the framers' mouth, not mine. And I'm hoping this inspires you to actually go read these documents for yourself. Don't take my word or anybody else's word for this stuff. You know, you hear these people, oh, this guy's a brilliant mind in the constitutional law. Don't believe the guy, especially if he's not telling you exactly what these guys said. And I'm telling you, this is so important. We can no longer live on the paraphrasing. We can no longer live on how people are interpreting what was said. We have to get back to the black and white issue of, was it in the Constitution or not? Was it defined by the framers or not? And I have already given you the evidence that the Congress was not able to create a law that did not apply to themselves. That was in the Massachusetts ratification debates. They were held to the same laws that they were to put on the people. So what happened? Well, they wiggled their way out of it. And we can actually point to the Constitution and say, hey, look, you guys can't be out of this healthcare system. It was defined in the Massachusetts debate that any law that you pass must be applied to you as well. That way, they remove their ability to create immunity for themselves, and they have to subject themselves to the same crap that they've subjected us to. Just like Social Security, they should not have their own retirement system. They should only have Social Security or any other privately invested retirement that they pay into. And as a matter of fact, here's the thing. If it's not a constitutional law, it's null and void, boom, it's gone. When we execute Republic Review, you really want to teach tyrants a lesson. Watch what happens to all of these fat cats, because as we go after them, everything that they have, everything the Pelosi has, practically everything, just like Kathy McMorris Rogers, she went into Congress as a poor person. She's a millionaire now. That shouldn't be happening. And so everything that she has, she has stolen from the people or used privilege in getting there. It's the same thing with Maxine Waters. It's the same thing with all of these corrupt politicians. And so the best way to fix all of this and permanently fix it is by applying Republic Review, getting Wyoming to stand up and getting Wyoming to lead the charge in initiating the audit and calling upon the other states to join. That's why we need your help. So let me also remind you that this is the only radio show that actually talks about these facts, that actually gets into these details. We don't always do this, but we do it so that when you get this, you get emerged in the facts. You are actually being empowered with knowledge. Let me also say this. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And there are ways you can support us. And so we will get into the ratification debates when we come back. And so please stay tuned, and we'll be diving into what Mr. Wilson also has to say regarding the power of the people and the sovereignty of the people. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so there's ways you can support this show. One of those ways is by showing us some love, is going out to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and clicking on the link to Red State Coffee. Now, if you go to Red State Coffee, they offer beans and grinds. And what we would ask is you at least try this. And if this isn't one of your best cups of coffee, let us know. Just dial 425-270-5416. And so that way, you will be able to actually help us promote this, because we're pretty confident that you will be impressed.
Now, this isn't a toll-free number, but I don't know anybody that pays for long distance anymore. And I don't want to digress on this, but I won't. I will leave that for another day. There's other ways you can support us with our crowdfunding with GoFundMe, and that link is also on reclaimingtherepublic.org as well. We would love to have you get involved, though. That is where we really need your help. We need your help in the local level. Email us, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. We don't want to have to stand here with our hands out, but we can't afford to subsidize the war. If we are going to win this, it's not even a revolution. If we're going to win taking our government back, then it only takes a little bit of effort. I mean, I just look at where I am in the successes that we have and we've been enjoying over the past year, and I just can't believe it. I mean, we are much further along than I could even have anticipated with a zero budget, well, $90 over the past year that have been contributed. And so I'm a little bit humbled, but I'm also willing to share the blessings. That's why, you know, I'm willing to allow your contributions to help pay for the efforts. I'm not asking for labor. We're not looking to try to pay anybody a wage in this. So get on board and, you know, roll up your sleeves and start working for yourself in leading and taking your state and county back. So let me just dive into this whole paradigm that Mr. Wilson has been painting, that the people are the sovereigns. And actually, I'm sorry, it's not Mr. Wilson we're going to get into. It's Mr. McKean. And I think at this point, we don't have much more from Mr. Wilson. Actually, I only have two more quotes from Mr. McKean. So with that, let me just kind of dive into this. And Mr. McKean states this, that in all cases enumerated, except where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction. And he says, quote, they shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Now, here's the question for you. Where did Congress give them the ability to reach into state issues, such as marriage, such as life, such as health care, and those types of things? They never did. Moving on, he says, from this it is inferred that the trial by jury is not secured, because this whole argument he's setting up was basically replying to this concept that the Constitution was not implying that everybody had a right to trial by jury, that it is not secured. And an objection is set up to the system because they have jurisdiction between citizens of different states. Regulations under this head are necessary, but the convention could form no one that would have suited each of the United States. It has been a subject of amazement to me to hear gentlemen contend that the verdict of a jury shall be without revision in all cases. Juries are not infallible because they are a 12 in number. When the law is so blended with the fact as to be so inseparable, may not the decision of a jury be erroneous? Notwithstanding, this trial by jury is the best mode that is known. Mr. McKean goes on as well and says this, again, because it is unnecessary for the powers of Congress being derived from the people, the mode pointed out by this Constitution and being therein enumerated and positively granted can be no other than what this positive grant conveys. And this was a quote he made from Locke on Civil Government, Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 2, Section 140, and in the 13th chapter, Section 152. It's kind of amazing to me when you really start looking at all of the different books that they used, Locke and Montesquieu, were two of the most prominent, and I mean that, two of the most prominent books that they utilized as supporting their arguments and forming the government the way they did. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the what we'll call the Pennsylvania ratification debate highlights. These are the extracts. What I want you to do is I want you to understand that there is a plethora of content out there, you know, from the Federalist Papers and so forth. Anybody that is citing the Federalist, or not the, yeah, the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, let's just deal with those. Those two sets of articles and documents are only opinions and insights. They have no legal base. They may be very insightful, but they have no legal base. And why is that important? Why is legal base important? Because if you are arguing that this means this and this means that and that means this, then you have to have some legal base to state that. And with the ratification debates, it is very clear that these have legal base because these were the documents that were used to secure the ratification of the Constitution. That's why this is so important. Okay? So we're going to start off with Mr. McLean in the ratification debates in North Carolina. I'm not going to New York. We will wait on New York until a little bit later. I may just use New York last because it is one of the most voluminous arguments in favor of the Constitution and against the Constitution. I mean, both sides were, you know, very weighty in words. I think it's like 700 pages. However, it is probably the most air-filled and the least substanced within all the debates. And so that's one of the reasons why. And that's because Hamilton was driving the train. And Hamilton was not trying to provide any legal footing. He was very careful not to do that. Well, so to be clear, if one state makes an assertion, such as in Massachusetts, they make an assertion that all laws passed by Congress must be applicable to Congress as well. Even if that is only clearly stated in Massachusetts, it doesn't matter. It is applied across the spectrum. Why? Because the Constitution cannot be differentiated differently between one state and the other. The only time we would really have a wrench in the works is if, and I said this before, if a state came along and said, hey, we believe the Constitution is a living document. The federal government is going to be able to do anything it wants to. Basically, if Hamilton was really honest and came right out and said, well, what we want to do is we want to end up changing this president into a king, a monarch. And then what we want to do is we want to change the sovereignty of the states to become just administrative functions for the federal government. That's what we're going to end up doing. Then they ratified it and accepted that and became a member of the union, then those testimonies would be a direct conflict with all of the other states. And now we would have a wrench in the works. But the fact is that there is no wrench in the works. You will not find anything to that level of contrast, to that big of a conflict between what all the other framers said in all the other states to another state. So let me jump into the North Carolina debates, because since we finished the Pennsylvania debates, the gentleman, I've got a minute, so I'll wander into this. The gentleman has wandered out of his way to tell us what has so often been said out of doors, that there is no Declaration of Rights, that consequently all our rights are taken away. It would be very extraordinary to have a Bill of Rights because the power of Congress are expressly defined. And the very definition of them is as valid and efficacious a check as a Bill of Rights could be, without the dangerous implications of the Bill of Rights. You know, this makes me think right here. I'm going to stop right here. So I got about 30 seconds. As I was saying, there was no conflict. As you listen to me tell you these exact same, or these testimonies in these different states that state the exact same thing, that you don't need a Bill of Rights because we've got these enumerated locked-in powers. That's all they can do. Now you can start seeing that there is this harmonious spirit, this harmonious tone as to how the Constitution was defined. There was no wiggle room. What happened was we were lied to. We were deceived by dubious people, by nefarious men with machinations and designs to self-aggrandize power in the federal government so that they could start doing more things to us. So when we get back, we will finish Mr. McLean's comments regarding the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, so as I was kind of looking at this, the imagery that came to mind was kind of interesting because as Mr. McLean started off, the gentleman has wandered out of his way to tell us what has been so often said out of doors. In other words, making these huge proclamations and notifications to the public, right? The town crier. That there is no Declaration of Rights. In other words, people just running around with their heads cut off, all, you know, frazzled that there's no Declaration of Rights in this new Constitution. And the reason why it was so important is because in Britain, because these former subjects of Britain, they had a declaration of a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights meant it was a level of protection from the king. What these men created was they created an enumerated constitution that didn't require a declaration of a Bill of Rights. And so they didn't need to place a check on the federal government, which was basically, again, that Bill of Rights. So what they were trying to do, what they were trying to argue is, oh, we've got to have this. And as it was stated in Massachusetts, all of the other states, they didn't have Bill of Rights. were they being oppressed by the state government? Why would they be concerned, especially when the Constitution is an enumerated, not a general constitution? You have to remember that Britain, the king had, he had general powers. He did not have enumerated powers. Parliament, they had nothing but general powers. There was very little enumeration in that they could do these things. They were just given the powers to do anything and everything. They were, as it was described, they were both a democracy, a republican form of government, and a monarchy, because people were being able to get elected. And what ended up happening to an American system is very similar. We now have a democracy where people can vote, and people really believe that they can vote for health care, they can vote for benefits, and they're not constrained by a constitution. And that we have representatives that think that they're not bound by that constitution as well, and we have presidents that believe that they're not bound by that constitution, and we have a Supreme Court that believes that they're not bound. Everybody believes that the federal government and all of its branches or different departments have all of these general powers, and that is the furthest thing from the truth. Anyway, Mr. McLean goes on and says, the powers of Congress are limited and enumerated. We say we have given them those powers, but we do not say we have given them more. We retain all those rights which we have not given away to the general government. Is this so? I'm telling you, these are the exact, you'd think that the same men were in the same places, because they were saying almost the exact same thing as they were selling the Constitution to the states. The gentleman is a professional man. If a gentleman had made his last will and testament, and devised or bequeathed to a particular person the sixth part of his property, or any particular specific legacy, could it be said that that person should have the whole estate? If they can assume powers not enumerated, there was no occasion for enumerating any powers. The gentleman has learned, or learned, he's educated is what he's saying, without recurring to his learning, he may only appeal to his common sense. It will inform him that if we had all power before and had given away but a part, we still retain the rest. It is as plain a thing as possible, as possibly can be, that Congress can have no power but what we expressly give them. There is an express clause which, however disingenuously it has been perverted from its true meaning, clearly demonstrates that they are confined to those powers which are given them. This clause enables them to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into the execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States, or any department or officers thereof. This, and that's where he was quoting the Article 1, Section 8, Necessary and Proper Clause. And he says, this clause specifies that they shall make laws to carry into execution all powers vested by this Constitution. Consequently, they can make no laws to execute any other power, like health care, like education, like energy, like labor, like agriculture, like housing and urban development. This clause gives no new power, but declares that those already given are to be executed by proper laws. I hope this will satisfy gentlemen, whoever he was talking to, right? And so there you have a very well-stated argument that was just like the other states' arguments regarding the necessary and proper clause. Now, every state struggled with every single one of these things, and it is not amazing, and it is not a coincidence that they all defined them the same way. I'd like to tell you, I'd like to introduce you to the evidence of the divine hand of providence. That is why these documents were so important to the discovery of these days, that we could wake up and recognize the fact that we were given a contract, that the states have this authority, and that they clearly defined what authority was given to the federal government in its origins and how it had to act. Folks, we've got it. Anyway, there's plenty more evidence, though. I believe that if I overwhelm you with all the evidence, then you have to scream uncle at some point. And I know there's probably some people with the Massachusetts rather. Oh, uncle, oh, I get it. I completely get it. No, there is so much more evidence we have yet to even cover, or uncover, I should say. And when we cover those things, you will be blown away at, one, the consistency, and two, the details and the depth that these men covered these issues. So the next person that speaks is Governor Johnston. And Governor Johnston is, so here's a contrast to Governor Clinton. Governor Clinton of New York was an anti-federalist, and he was threatened by these new powers that were going to be given to this new general government. And so but Governor Johnson, Governor Hancock, Governor Randolph didn't see the threats. Those are three governors, which was the governor of Massachusetts, Hancock. Randolph was the governor of Virginia. And here's Governor Johnston. And all three of these governors are in support of this new constitution. So what the heck? Why? Why did Clinton see this need to stop the Constitution? Why was he an anti-federalist? Well, obviously, he had something in the game. He had vested interest to protect, which was protecting his powers and control over the people. He did not want to have to compete with this new government that had these new powers. Anyway, here's Governor Johnston, and he says, Mr. Chairman, the learned member from Anson says that the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction of all cases in law equity arising under this Constitution and laws of the United States. The opinion which I have always entertained is that they will, in these cases, as well as in several others, have concurrent jurisdiction with the state courts and not exclusive jurisdiction. I see nothing in this Constitution which hinders a man from bringing suit wherever he thinks he can have justice done him. The jurisdiction of these courts is established for some purposes with which the state courts have nothing to do, and the Constitution takes no power from the state or from the state courts, which they now have. They will and have the same business which they have now, and if so, they will have enough to employ their time. Apparently, people were worried that the judges and lawyers would become unemployed. That would have been a good thing. We know that the gentlemen who preside in our superior courts have more business than they can determine. Their complicated jurisdiction and great extent of country occasions them a vast deal of business. The addition of the business of the United States would be no manner of advantage to them. It is obvious to everyone that there ought to be one Supreme Court for national purposes, but the gentleman says that a Bill of Rights was necessary. Bill of Rights was necessary. It appears to me, sir, sorry I got lost there, that it would have been the highest absurdity to undertake to define what rights of the people of the United States were entitled to. For would it be as much as they would say they were entitled to nothing else? A Bill of Rights may be necessary. Oh, I have that heartbreak. Uh-oh. So I'm going to have to finish this good governor's comments about a Bill of Rights and the jurisdiction of the courts when we come back after this break. So please stay tuned and we'll be diving right back into the North Carolina. I love these debates, by the way. The North Carolina debates are awesome. We will be right back after this. Thank you so much. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. And so as Governor Johnston was just saying, and I will carry on from where I left off, a Bill of Rights may be necessary in a monarchical government whose powers are undefined. That's just what I was telling you. Were we in the situation of a monarchical country? No, sir. Well, they were until the revolution. No, sir. Every right could not be enumerated, and the omitted rights would be sacrificed if security arose from an enumeration. The Congress cannot assume any other powers than those expressly given them. Bam! There it is right there, folks. Congress cannot assume any other powers than those expressly given them without a palpable violation of the Constitution. I mean, those are just beautiful words, right? I mean, that's about as succinct as Madison. Anyway, moving on. Such objections as this, I hope, will have no effect on the minds of any members in this House. When gentlemen object generally that it tends to consolidate the states and destroy their state judiciaries, they ought to explicit and explain their meaning. They make use of contradictory arguments. And as a matter of fact, I know that Madison, and this is so much like Madison, what he was saying here, because Madison made the same thing. Give us examples. Show us. Don't just make these blanketed comments like this. So anyway, when gentlemen object generally that it tends to consolidate the states and destroy their state judiciaries, they ought to be explicit and explain their meaning. They make use of contradictory arguments. The Senate represents the states and can alone prevent this dreaded consolidation. Yet the powers, and actually they can't. I mean, they can work to stop it, but only the states have the true authority to stop and undo things. Congress doesn't. There was no power given to Congress to be able to stop and do all sorts of things. The rights of the people, in my opinion, cannot be affected by the federal courts. Well, until Hamilton perverted them, right? I do not know how inferior courts will be regulated. Some suppose the state courts will have this business. Others have imagined that the continent would be divided into a number of districts. Very insightful, because that's what's happened. Where courts would be held so as to suit the convenience of the people. Whether this or some other mode will be appointed by Congress, I do not know. But this I am sure of, that the state judiciaries are not divested of their present judicial cognizance, and that we have every security that our ease, convenience will be consulted. Unless Congress had this power, their laws could not be carried into execution. You know, here's one of the things, and I'm just going to digress really quickly. On the courts themselves, yeah, we have courts and they're in districts, but it's still, with today's technology, it's still insane to have to go to the Ninth Circuit Court or wherever the district court seat is. With the ability of doing virtualization, every state should be able to offer virtualization, just so that those people sitting on those federal judges will, you know, have to be able to deal with a better efficiency, so that they can actually go straight into arguments, you know, instead of having, you know, to walk into court at the beginning of each. Nope, they just go to the next one. In doing a virtual court, you know, and giving so much time to, you know, for this court and then going to this court and then going to this court and going, they could be so much more efficient. These men are hardly working. I mean, it's a pleasure for them to work because they're doing exactly what they love. It's like those guys that like wrestling with pigs. I mean, you know, some people really enjoy that. They get a lot of release from that. And I think that those with the legal minds, they like doing that. But technically, it is a huge inefficient way of judges to work. I honestly believe that the district courts should be disbanded anyway, that each state should have its own federal court, if you want to say so, where, you know, you have different judges and so forth. And I'll get into that when we talk about the court system, because the court system is so, so bad. And even though back in these days they were huge on the concept of lifetime appointments, they were not very good at cleaning up and defining good behavior. Just like employees at a corporation, well, we really think you're slacking off here. You're not carrying your caseload. You're not doing enough. Sorry, your behavior is subpar. We're going to let you go. We're going to replace you. We need to have better standards for judges. And you do realize that when you do these types of, make these kind of comments, that they always come right around, so that someday when I'm standing in court, a judge is going to hear these words and he's going to say, well, so Mr. Mobley, and okay, you know, the things do have a way of coming around, don't they? Anyway, here's one of my favorite men in the arguments for the Constitution, Mr. Iredell. And this is where he refers to the Constitution as a power of attorney. Mr. Iredell says this: did any man ever hear before that at the end of a power of attorney it was said that the attorney should not exercise more power than was there given him? Suppose, for instance, a man had lands in the counties of Anson and Coswell, and he should give another a power of attorney to sell his lands in Anson. Would the other have any authority to sell the lands in Coswell? Or could he, without absurdity, say, 'Tis true you have not expressly authorized me to sell lands in Coswell, but as you had lands there and did not say I should not, I thought I might as well sell those lands as the other.' A Bill of Rights, as I've conceived, would only be incongruous but dangerous. No man, let his ingenuity be what it will, could enumerate all the individual rights not relinquished by this Constitution. Suppose, therefore, an enumeration of a great many, but an omission of some, and that long after all traces of our present disputes were at an end, like in today's times, any of the omitted rights would be invaded and the invasion be complained of, what would be the plausible answer of the government to such a complaint? Would they not naturally say, we live in a great distance from the time when this Constitution was established? We can judge of it much better by the ideas of it entertained at the time than by any ideas of our own. The Bill of Rights passed at the time showed that the people did not think every power retained, which was not given, else the Bill of Rights was not useless, but absurd. But we are not at liberty to charge an absurdity upon our ancestors who have given such strong proofs to their good sense, as well as their attachment to liberty. Well, unfortunately, they got some of this wrong. So long as the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights remain, I'm just saying the way they were talking about how good we would be and how we would have an attachment to liberty. I mean, people today have no attachment to liberty. Anyway, so long as the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights remain unviolated, you have no reason to complain. This is not one of them. Thus, a Bill of Rights might operate as a snare rather than a protection if we have formed a general legislature with undefined powers. A Bill of Rights would not only have been proper but necessary, and it would have then operated as an exception to the legislative authority in such particulars. It has this effect in respect to some American constitutions where the powers of legislation are general, but where there are powers of a particular nature and expressly defined, as in the case of the Constitution before us. I think for the reason I have given, a Bill of Rights is not only unnecessary, but it would be absurd and dangerous. And so, very, very, very good articulated argument in helping people understand. And in all honesty, there were other people that argued very similar arguments. The difference? I think that by using the metaphor of the power of attorney, it really put it into a perspective that most people can associate with. That's why I think it was one of the more powerful comments and arguments regarding the enumeration, the limitations of the enumeration, as well as the lack of a need for a Bill of Rights. So the next comment that we have is Mr. Iredell, and I really don't have enough time. I'm looking and I got less than 30 seconds left. So what I'm going to do is we're going to cut it off here. And when we come back in our next episode, we are going to cover more of these debates, more specifically these debates. And what we're going to hit coming up is in North Carolina, we're going to see how they looked at slavery and how they saw the trends in the United States. And they recognized the importance of getting on board with this union while it still had baked into it these protections, because they know down the road, and it may not have been an open conversation as open as we would have liked, but they know down the road there could have been a better likelihood that the rest of the states would have willingly given up slavery and they would have been out in a hard situation. And so with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We'll be back. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.